Welcome to the Impactful Innovators podcast series. This series is produced from the fall 2020 class at Rensselaer Polytechnic Institute and sponsored by the National Science Foundation and the Severino Center for Technological Entrepreneurship at RPI. This series highlights the stories of entrepreneurs and innovators as they go through the challenging process of changing the world. If you enjoyed the podcast, please subscribe to the Severino Center for Technological Entrepreneurship on YouTube or connect with us on Facebook and Twitter. We hope that this series will help inspire the next generation of innovators, entrepreneurs, and intrapreneurs at Rensselaer and beyond. Today's episode will feature Dr. Patrice Milos, class of 1982, who co-founded Medley Genomics to deliver novel data analytics for individualizing treatment of complex diseases with an initial focus in oncology. Having worked in the field for several years, she was ready to make an impact by charting her own path after becoming inspired as the CEO of a Boston Children's Hospital spin-out, Claritas Genomics. Patrice earned her MS and PhD at Rensselaer Polytechnic Institute with postdoctoral fellowships at Brown and Harvard.
First, I wanted to say hello. It's always fun to see people in person. I really do miss the fun opportunity interact live, but it also makes it easier for people, I think, to join and participate, ask questions, and it's great to be here. And I really do love doing this because I think the more you can understand a little bit about what awaits you externally, the better entrepreneur you will be. And my story is perhaps a little different than your typical entrepreneur. I'm located in Providence, Rhode Island, and I work a lot with students at Brown who are always starting companies as undergraduates. And my area of expertise, I got my PhD at RPI in biology, so I've been in the life sciences for my whole career. And I've traveled a different path to entrepreneurship than many people who leave college and start companies. And when Jason and others and I were talking, Kelly and Rachel, back when they invited me, I thought it may be relevant because I think that in my career, I started soon after my postdoc in biotech, but pretty quickly as that biotech went out of business, I went to big pharma. And I think it's an experience that many of you will have the opportunity as you look at some of the big companies who will be recruiting for people from RPI. And so it's always this question of, do I want to be an entrepreneur now? What can I learn if I go to a Boeing or a big company? And that has been my path. So I thought it might be a little different than your typical entrepreneurship talk. I will share it. And then what I've got is three different scenarios of personal experiences that were key decision points in my career that are always fun to talk to students about. And what would you do if you were faced with this situation or that? So I think I'll start and I'll share my slides. I thought I would start with the whole story because it's a good thing to keep in mind as I go along. The story is really my professional career milestone, so you get a sense of that. So in some respects, it's not just about entrepreneurship, it's about a career that now is wedded in entrepreneurship. So after my postdoc, I went to a company called Transgenic Sciences, which is in Worcester, Mass., and it was a great startup company. It had just gone public, and we developed the first transgenic animal model for Alzheimer's disease. And unfortunately, the company went out of business, but they sold the model to a company called Athena in San Francisco. And Athena used the model for a lot of their drug discovery and drug development. So after a foray in a startup of about 30-person company, I went to Pfizer Global Research and Development in Groton, Connecticut. And it was about a 25,000-person pharmaceutical company. This was around 1993. So it was this new era of genomics and interfacing with pharmaceutical R&D. What was great is it was a big company. We had three different locations, but it really provided the foundational background that I use to this day. And that is, how do you discover, develop, and really market pharmaceutical life-saving medicines in the real world? What was great about my experience at Pfizer is I was able to start within the company a very innovative group, which was called the Pharmacogenomics Group. And at that time, it was this whole field of precision medicine, and we're going to make medicines that are really optimized therapy for individuals. And it was heretical, if you were thinking about this at the time, in 1996, 1997, to be saying Pfizer was interested in truly personalized medicine. Today, it's the norm. It's a given. But back then, I'll tell you, the arguments that we would have at the executive level were amazing. Almost fistfights. Why would we ever want to do this? Why would we ever want to study Lipitor or Zoloft as it relates to response? But it was great because it was really entrepreneurial within a big company where you're learning all the foundational elements of the field of life sciences and doing innovation within it. I was there for 14 years, and it was really my passion for personalized medicine, personalized healthcare, that said, I can't work in this big company environment anymore. When I joined, it was a 25,000 person company. When I left in 2007, it was 110,000 people. And my job was, after the third integration, to move chairs rather than do science. I said, okay, I've gained all this expert knowledge. I'm going to go use it. So I went to a biotech company in Cambridge, Mass, which is any of the life sciences is the hotbed now, today, of biotechnology, pharmaceutical, R&D, and so forth. And I went to a company called Helicos Biosciences as the chief scientific officer, again, a public company. We developed the world's first single molecule DNA sequencing platform, which was scientifically, for me, a remarkable feat. And I published in Science and Nature, but the company was not successful. So after 5 years, I was like the third person left at the company. And I wound up going back to Pfizer for a little while in a whole new model that they were building around how to innovate with R&D through public-private partnerships. I lasted about 14 months back there, and it really was still the same old Pfizer, although the concept of precision health, personalized medicine, had been dramatically embraced by the company. And I still remember my first day going back into Pfizer, and the company was in Cambridge then, and seeing on the elevator a bullseye with an arrow saying the right target, the right medicine for the right population. And I said, boy, this is a different Pfizer. And it is reflected across all pharma now that they have embraced precision medicine. At Pfizer, in the Center for Therapeutic Innovation, I was recruited away to join and be the founding CEO of a company called Claritas Genomics, which was a company we founded out of Boston Children's Hospital. So essentially, we took a core group of people out of Boston Children's Hospital and built a commercial pediatric molecular diagnostic company that I led for almost 3 years, raised money, did a lot of innovative, amazing work in really, I understood drug discovery. I learned drug development. I went into the marketplace with some teams. But now we were really focused on diagnosing rare pediatric disorders. It's a long story about the majority of rare diseases occur in pediatrics. It's a long search for answers at that quest. And often parents and their child will go for years without ever getting an accurate diagnosis. And we set about to change that. And the whole field has embraced this now, and more you'll see the field of molecular diagnostics in kids really having dramatic impact, not only in diagnosing, but also this drive towards an N of one therapy, which is really quite remarkable. We worked on the diagnosis for a child with a rare neuromuscular disorder. One of our co-founders of Claritas actually was able to identify the genetic mutation that we did and create a single modifying oligonucleotide that they could deliver into the brain of the patient to ameliorate the symptoms in that child. And it was published in New England Journal of Medicine about a year ago and has really changed the course of the types of thinking about the kind of therapies that exist for patients. After 3 years there, I think the common theme throughout my career is I really like living on the cutting edge of innovation. And once you build something and it becomes very routine, it's time for me to move on. It sounds crazy, but after 3 years and everything's going along, the challenges are very different and they're not the kind of challenges that excite me. So I turned Claritas Genomics over to my Series B investors, people that came in and invested over $10 million in the company. They wanted to run the company. I said, great. And so I did that. And then I found myself with a little bit of time off for a while, for the first time, because I'd never taken time off. My daughter was a senior at University of Rochester. She was playing lacrosse, and I was determined for her senior year, I was going to make every one of her games. So I took that 6 months off. I used it to rethink about what I wanted to do. And I found a partner at Brown University to start a Medley Genomics, which was a data analytics company in oncology focused on the heterogeneity of patient tumors. And that is the challenge with cancer is we can treat the patient, but what happens is that treatment will often be effective for a year or two or three, but then all these little cells that exist in the tumor that are resistant to that therapy will emerge, and the patient then has metastatic disease or a recurrence of the cancer. And what we felt is if we better understood that patient at the very beginning, we might be better off in how we would develop a course of therapy. I think what I realized after 3 years, and we were funded initially, and then we had an NIH grant, is it was going to take us $30 million, $40 million to really prove why that information would matter. Because pharmas really want to treat the patient and cure, you know, treat them for 6 months and reduce their tumor burden and get drug approval. It's a lot different course if you're thinking about how am I going to prolong a patient's life for 5 or 10 years. And that's the hope that we had with combination therapy. The company is now winding down. And about 3 weeks ago, I got a call from a gentleman by the name of Fen Zhang from the Broad, MIT, who is one of the original inventors of CRISPR-Cas9, which is this whole new science that allows you to go in and genetically modify a genome, or it's also being used for diagnostic purposes because it recognizes particular sequences. And Fang has started a company called Pine Trees Health, which is aiming to deliver rapid point of care, low cost COVID-19 molecular diagnostic platform into the marketplace to really have an impact on the pandemic that is before us right now. When he called, I said, when do I start? Which is why my world is crazy right now. So I start on Monday. And for me, it's the pinnacle of everything I know, all brought into one: technology, diagnostics, FDA, regulatory, clinical. And I do so hope we will be successful. So you'll hear more about that. All right, so let's go. So I think in some respects, as you develop your career, you really have to understand your personal goal. And my personal goal has always been what I state here, and that is to improve patient lives through my passion for personalized healthcare and application of innovative and science and technology to understand human disease. And I think as you saw in every one of those decisions I made career-wise, this personal goal was part of why that just happened to be where I wound up. You'll get to career decisions, you make those decisions, but it's all driven by my passion for personalization of healthcare. I think the other thing that's fun is you always leave a footprint, and I feel like I have a decent footprint. You can find me on LinkedIn, you can find me on web pages, different conferences, and networking, again, is so important as you continue your quest in your career. And then this is probably the most fun, And that it's not just all about career, but it's about surrounding yourself with a great partner. And my husband really has been a great partner from the beginning. We have two children. They're really amazing. And they're both doing great. Henry's studying for his bar exam right now, which will be online. Hannah is at UMass Worcester Medical Center in her second year there. She's doing great. And our dog. And we sail. I think it's the grounding through anything you do as a career is keeping grounded with a great partner, having things to do. And Kurt was the regional administrator of EPA for New England under President Obama. So it wasn't like he was a lightweight. He ran an organization in Rhode Island called Save the Bay. Save the Bay did amazing things. So it was always this balance, and we pretty well managed. The one thing I did to stay sane is I never worked on Saturday. It was always my time to just unwind and do things. And I think as an entrepreneur, you need to find that space all the time. Growing as a leader, I think, and I have three examples that I thought would just be fun because you're going to be faced with these sort of thoughtful perspectives as you advance in your career. And so I have three different challenges that I experienced that I thought would be fun to just talk through and just get a perspective on what would you do in these kind of situations. Here's one example. Growing as a leader, I joined Pfizer in 1993. I was a bench scientist, but yet I was asked if I wanted to establish the pharmacogenomics group in 1996. And I said, yeah, why not? So 3 years onto something new. And that's the great thing about a big company is that you can often evolve in a big company to be doing different things. And it really shaped me. So I started the group. I grew it to about 20 people. And it was constantly challenging Pfizer to think about a future of personalized healthcare. Not that they really wanted to, but it really was good for them. And I think if they look back, those that are still there appreciated it. A really interesting thing happened, which is often happens in big companies, is in 2003, a challenge was presented to me where I was asked to take on a dysfunctional group where there had been serious problems, ethical problems in the group. The leader had been fired. And they asked me if I wanted to take on this group. What would you do in a situation like that as you're thinking about this in your career? You've got a great group that's just well regarded both internally and externally. And this is thrown at you within the world of a big organization. What do you do? All right, I'll tell you what I did. I first said no. So I went from being a senior executive at Pfizer and really understanding drug discovery, drug development, the marketing of therapeutics and so forth in precision medicine. And I was hired as the chief scientific officer at Helicos Biosciences. I think I was the 30th person hired, single molecule DNA sequencing. Company had just completed going public. And my job was to build the science at the company. It was a technology company. They were building an instrument and I had to develop the science. Where do you even start was the big question. And I'm thinking, okay, where do you start? Any ideas are faced with a situation like that? It's probably a hard one to think about because you don't really know what was single molecule sequencing doing. But what was clear is I had to first really understand the technology and what it was capable of. But I also had to help them understand what was possible with the technology. And they had this very strict idea of it had to do this and this. And they wouldn't even try sequencing a piece of DNA. And that's what the instrument was designed to do. And they had this big instrument. And they were like afraid to try. I said, we're going to cut up pieces of DNA. We're going to put them on your flow cell. And we're going to see what it does. And it worked. It was like, and so it was, again, take a little risk. Let's see what the platform can do today. And then let's think about what the platform can do for the scientific community. So what I did was, first of all, I hired a few really good people. And one of the threads that I like to think about in my career was a gentleman who was on the same hall when I was a postdoc at Brown, and he was a genius in molecular biology. He left to go to Pfizer. I left Brown and went to a startup in Worcester. And he's the first person I called when the company was going out of business. I was like, John, are there any jobs at Pfizer? Do you need me? And he's, yes, we have this position open. Come interview. And it's just one of those relationships. John and I have worked together. So he hired me at Pfizer, and he was a senior manager when he hired me. When I started the pharmacogenomics group, he decided he didn't want to be a senior manager anymore. He wanted to come and do science. So I hired him in the pharmacogenomics group at Pfizer. So he came and was really a key leader in the science that we were doing in the group. So I hired him at Helicos. And then so I left Pfizer. He was still in the pharmacogenomics group. I was at Helicos for about 6 months, and he called me up and he said, I can't do this anymore. Are there any positions? I said, John, absolutely. So John came and he joined me at Helicos as a key scientific leader, senior scientist in the applications and research group. And he helped me build the team. And we did great things together. As I said, at Helicos, we published, maybe 12 manuscripts in just top-rate journals, doing things that had never been done before. So it was great. We worked with the Broad. We worked with academic medical centers around the world, really, in helping them understand what was possible with our technology. But science wasn't enough. Commercially, it wasn't successful, I told you. So I went back to Pfizer. John went to a company in Providence, another DNA sequencing company. And then I wound up at Claritas Genomics as CEO. And as my first time as a CEO, entrepreneur, 10 people. And here was a very interesting situation where you're taking people who have worked in an academic hospital for some upwards of 20, 25 years, and you're trying to help them be entrepreneurial. And what it takes to really build and grow a company was really quite interesting and not always right for the fit for the people. We lost a lot of those people eventually. But when the opportunity presented, I brought John on to be the senior VP for R&D, so early development of all the commercial assays that would be used in the molecular diagnostic lab. And he did a great job. When I left Claritas, John was still there. Claritas closed about a year after I left. John went to work at a company in Baltimore and worked there for a little while, Precision Molecular Diagnostics, while I went back to Pfizer. When I started Medley Genomics, he was still at Precision Diagnostics. And then another colleague of ours hired him to a gene therapy company north of Boston. And just last week, I brought John on as a life science advisor for our Rhode Island bio organization. So there's just some people that you'll meet in your career that you just work well with. It's like a seamless mind meld that always, it's great to have a great partner like that as well. So we really started, we built the science group, we published, we did great things. Science isn't enough. The life at Medley has been interesting. Entrepreneur, startup from the very first idea, very different for me. So moved through stages of entrepreneurship to starting my own company 4 years ago, getting seed funding, getting an NIH grant, going out to all the pharmas and realizing what we were trying to do was going to take too long. And frankly, very difficult for a woman to raise that kind of money that we would need. And that's just brutal honesty, I found, particularly at my age and without successes that were real successes behind me. So it's an interesting time to be thinking about that. And I was thinking that I was winding down. I was managing the Cherrystone Angel Investment Group in Providence in the interim. And then you get this phone call and you just never know what will happen. And again, it came through a friend that I networked with, who was a colleague of Feng's at the Broad, a woman who has started four companies herself. Amazing. She had attempted to recruit me for a CEO for one of her companies, and I really wasn't ready for that. And she said to Feng, this is the woman you want. So he called me and checked my references, and the rest was history. So I think what you see is a career where I started in a big company and then I've gone more and more entrepreneurial, and I really do love the entrepreneurial community. It's fast, it's furious, it takes a lot of people skill. I think I learned in my days at Pfizer to be successful, but I really love the entrepreneur's journey, and it's different for everybody and it's different for every company. I'll let you know when I start on Monday how the next phase goes. I'm a little worried, but it'll be great.
Great. Thank you so much. That was wonderful.
It's fun to put it together and look at it. It really is great. And it's a lot of risk, believe me. When I leave Big Pharma and you have this great salary and you're going to the world of a startup and leaving one and starting one from scratch. And I think it really depends on different phases of your life too. Your family, your kids. My kids were out of college and I'm like, what the heck, why not?
Yeah, since just going off that, I feel like we've seen a lot of entrepreneurship at Rensselaer, but biotech has been in somewhat of a weak spot. It seems like there's, number one, there's these clusters, and number two, it just takes so much money. What you've been involved in has been very early stage, but there still has to be a tremendous amount of funding. So could you give us just maybe a little bit more context of how this really works in pharma and early stage startups that still need a lot of money to be successful?
Yeah, it's a good question. I think the other thing, Jason, is the dynamics are changing a lot these days. 10 years ago, maybe four pharma colleagues would get together. They had a very interesting idea for a new neuroscience company, and they would get some early seed stage funding from one of the venture capital firms that exist in Cambridge. There's Atlas, there's Flagship, and many like that. And they would raise a couple $1 million and they would use their chemistry skills to develop some molecules and do some animal model testing and maybe get it to the point where they had what they believed to be some safe molecules to take into the clinic. And they would do another round of fundraising. And it's really hard to raise that money. What we've seen more and more in the world of, let's take the example of Atlas Ventures in Cambridge. Atlas Ventures is actually, for the last 3 or 4 years, actually finding the ideas and starting the companies within their own walls. So they've been in this game long enough now. They know some of the winners. They know some of the seasoned executives. So they'll recruit them in to say, hey, we have this idea, or one of those entrepreneurs comes and says, hey, I have this idea. They present the idea. They'll incubate them within their walls of Atlas in Cambridge. And then they'll give them, say, $500,000 to this point. And if they get it that far, they may give them $2 million. And then if they're successful there, then that's when they probably bring in a conglomerate of additional investors. And that becomes what's the Series A, which might be $30 million to really take the company further. These are expensive experiments. We hear about the successes in the way they're doing it now. You don't hear as much about the failures because many of those early ideas never come to that $30 million Series A. So that's just one scenario. It's hard. It's really hard.
Three questions. First question is, do you have any tips for the minorities to climb the corporate ladder?
Yes.
Second is, how do you make your voice heard, especially as a female in those board meetings? And third is, how important is your PhD work and the post-PhD work?
Those are all three really important questions. So I think the time has never been better for minorities to be heard, because we are all recognizing that we've done, first of all, in life sciences in particular, people of color are so underrepresented. It is really a disservice to our industry because we need all the intellect that could come forward. I think, Julia, in the Asian community, it has been much more embraced in biotechnology. But again, it still is underrepresented. And I think people are paying much more attention to that now. So let's hope over the next 5 years that will change for both people of color, people of Asian descent. I can't tell you it will, but people are very alert to it now. Your second question was, how does a woman succeed? So
board meetings, how do you make, my understanding is, especially in large corporation, female and male sometimes are 2-8, 3-7, in the best scenario. And how do you participate and make your opinion and voice be the execution in the corporation?
Yes, it's really important to start at the very beginning and to raise your hand for what might be some challenging assignments that I always would think, oh, can I do this with my family? Can I do this? And it's always scarier until you're in it. And once you say, okay, I'd like to volunteer for that, and you get in it, it's a lot easier than you think. So you have to be willing to take a little bit of risk there. You have to have a seat at the table as early as you can. Your project teams, your every organization typically in life sciences engineering has project teams. You need to be well prepared. You need to come to the meeting, sit at the table. So many women would sit on the sidelines. I always sat at the table. I always did. I was never afraid. And it was mostly men around the table. But I would always look for an opportunity to add a different perspective, because I think women do, that are often not appreciated until it's raised as an issue. It's just the different way we look at science or technology. So, and the other thing is, oftentimes, people will distribute documents for comments and feedback. I always provided comments and feedback on any document that came on my desk, because I know I always could make it better. And so many people just don't. And I think that's, again, for any person to have your voice heard, your ideas, respond, give people feedback. They love it. They love when they can improve their documents. So those are a few areas that I think are important. I haven't faced true discrimination in the workplace. I've had a few circumstances, and I'll share one in which I was coming up for a promotion on the scientific ladder. And my boss was in there in that meeting, and he came back from the meeting and he said to me, one of the persons on the committee said, you were out on maternity leave for 3 months, and therefore we should delay until the next session. And he said, no, look what she's done. You know, it's all about the deliverables, and I was promoted. But if you don't have that ally, and we talk a lot about this, and I have a good friend, David Smith, who's written a book called Athena Rises. Women need male allies. In this case, it was my boss. Not only was he willing to tell me, but he was willing to speak up. And it happened because he was willing to do that. So the fact that he would speak up and then come and tell me that happened was so heartening to me, that your boss or allies can really help support your career path. And that's really important.
So we'll take the last question from Jake.
Yeah, I just wanted to know if there's any specific skills you think are really important to like biotech and pharma CEOs. You know, beyond, we talk about people skills, obviously, these broad spectrum stuff that all CEOs should have. But is there anything really that you think someone in pharma or biotech should really have?
So I think, Jake, one of the most important things is your presence and your ability to communicate effectively, your ideas in a way with clarity, and it takes a long time. I also think, so it's your presence, it's your communication style. A fundamental challenge I had early on in my career is I was far too emotional, and you have to learn to be calm and have a presence that's viewed as calm for people to further respect you. And I got feedback on just that perspective of my personality. I'm a total extrovert, so I always want to talk and I'm always emotional. And particularly for a woman, you have to be conscious of that, because I'm just being honest, to many of your male counterparts in life sciences, engineering, technology, they're all introverts and they just don't know what to do with this woman. So I learned it's really important. I can have fun and do this. And I think I'm further enough along in my career that I can be a little emotional more sometimes. I don't have to prove anything to anybody. But as you're going through your career, you do.
This is wonderful. Thank you all for coming.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Impactful Innovators podcast series. Be sure to continue listening as we explore more of the stories of entrepreneurs and innovators as they go through the challenging process of changing the world. Thank you again to the National Science Foundation and the Severino Center for Technological Entrepreneurship for making this podcast possible. If you enjoyed the podcast, please subscribe to the Severino Center for Technological Entrepreneurship on YouTube, share it with a friend, or connect with us on Facebook and Twitter. We hope that this series will help inspire the next generation of innovators, entrepreneurs, at Rensselaer and beyond.